The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning. And in July, deadly flooding along the Mississippi River swept through St. Louis and eastern Kentucky. In October, river levels reached historic lows outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And these are the extremes that we were told we could expect by the scientists who study such things. And now that they're here, what can we expect next? What can we do to mitigate the damage? And without the flow of the Mississippi, what's to become of our agricultural economy? Join our conversation by calling us this morning with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. Your questions as well. You can always email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest this morning is Dennis Toddy, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. And Dennis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
All right. And I appreciate you joining us because I'm curious about how conditions on the river are varying from the upper Mississippi along the Wisconsin border to further south near Tennessee and Arkansas.
Well, you get a wide range of conditions. The background of this all is widespread dryness and drought across the central part of the U.S. The upper part of the Mississippi is low, but not as bad as it is what we call the lower Mississippi. And the lower Mississippi is, below Cairo, Illinois, where the Ohio River comes in. And that's kind of our problem right now is the Ohio River is low along with the Mississippi, as well as the other rivers that come into the Mississippi. So the lower Mississippi is at a very critical situation right now with very low flows and limiting some of the barge traffic along there because of this widespread dryness. Upper Mississippi is not as bad, but it's still in lower levels also. So we're at a situation where this widespread drought and dryness really is leading us to a situation of needing more rainfall soon for us to be able to keep the Mississippi River open and traffic moving along it.
And historically speaking, put this in context with what we've seen along the Mississippi in the past.
From recent history, the last two comparisons in recent memory would be in the major drought in 2012. We had limited traffic at that point. The situation on the lower Mississippi is more the problem right now. Back in 2012, the problem was more between Missouri and Illinois, where there are some areas of rock that they were able to get rid of and move some traffic there. The other one was back in 1988, where we had also had widespread drought. Three times in the last 45 years that we've seen something on this order.
And how long can we expect this to last, Dennis? What does the USDA Midwest Climate Hub know about the length of this drought?
Well, and that's, I guess, that there's two parts to this question. One, you have the widespread dryness that's leading to this. The other part is the time of year. We're in the fall and early winter. If you look at what happens in the way of climate, this is a lower flow time of year anyway, because our peak times of precipitation and runoff will be in the spring, because in the spring you've got snow melt from the farther north areas, like Wisconsin and the northern plains, hopefully. So that leads to additional runoff. Plus you have more spring rainfalls that is typically falling on either frozen ground or ground that is already wet, that's had soil moisture recharge in it. So that's leading to more runoff. By this time of year, soils tend to be drier because we're late in the year, less precipitation, and then crops, other plants that grow, take water out of the soil, so they dry the soil out. So you've got the background, what usually happens in climate, and then you have the major drought that we've had going on for this year or up to 2 years, even in the situation out in the plains, or somewhat longer. So that combination has left us with really needing a lot of moisture. Okay, back to your original question. How long can this last? We're probably going to continue to have some low flow issues throughout the winter. There is some level of optimism looking at the outlooks right now that we could ease a little bit, but it's probably going to be pretty dicey until the spring. And the reason why we think there's some level of optimism, even your forecast talked about some chances for precipitation. the winter outlook overall has some increased chances for precipitation in the eastern Corn Belt, the eastern part of the Midwest that drains into the Ohio River. So that would likely mean some additional rainfall, get some more flow in the Ohio, and that leads to the Mississippi. But the area further to the west and further to the north, we'll have to wait until spring before we start getting a lot of help in the way of runoff there, because as we get into winter, we don't get as much rainfall. We tend to get more snowfall and the water that will sit there until it melts in the springtime. We can get rain in the winter, and that would be beneficial too. But really, we need lots of rainfall and lots of snowfall. We don't want to wish a bad winter on anyone, but a big snowfall winter in northern areas would be a great benefit for this. So looks like, and there's some level for optimism right now that the river is they're going to be able to keep it moving along. But for this fully to resolve, it's probably going to be late winter, early spring by the time we start seeing a lot of improvement here.
We're talking about some of the record low water levels we're seeing on the Mississippi River and how it's affecting the Wisconsin and the Midwest with Dennis Totte, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. And if you're along the Mississippi, join us with what you see this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. What does this mean for our farmers, Dennis, whether it's in the fields or whether it's taking their crops to market? How does this impact our agricultural economy?
Well, you've got a twofold thing going on, because there's what goes out and then what comes back up. And so the first part is the Mississippi River is a major transport area of crops out. Corn and soybeans going to export. The expert part is not part of what we usually do, so I can't give you numbers, but it is a major way of getting corn and soybeans out. And when you limit the amount of barges going downriver, or you limit the amount you can put in barges, which is what they've been doing so far, that doesn't allow more of that crop for export. And producers then end up losing some money on this because there's more cost for transport and they can't necessarily transport when they want to. So there's a loss of income from that standpoint. So that's what's going out. The other part is what's coming back up the river. There's fertilizer and some other things that are shipped upriver that have to be put on in the spring. So, you're starting to get transport of fertilizer and other things to have in place by the time we get around towards spring applications. There's really not much more application that's going to happen this time of year. So we have some time until the spring, but it limits the amount we can get upriver. This is a problem we have sometimes when we have major flooding is they're still trying to get things upriver for spring fertilizer applications. And those are limited sometimes. The offside now is we're limiting that barge traffic to be able to get those transported upriver into our areas. Just a quick sidelight that people may not realize, there's also another impact with tourism, not as much in the upper river, but the lower part of the river, that there are tourist boats that go along the river. They've had to adapt, shift, move around, whatever. Something I didn't realize, but I've learned as we've been dealing with this issue over the last several months.
And Dennis, when we talk about the need for more precipitation to renew the water levels along the Mississippi, why are extreme rain events or some flooding that we've seen not helpful?
Well, you pointed out correctly that we did have a couple major events around St. Louis and eastern Kentucky. Those did end up in the river. The problem was, if you look around around the whole Mississippi River Basin, which goes all the way from the Appalachians to the Rockies and throughout the plains, that whole area was dry to severe drought this year. So you have a couple small areas that had heavy rainfalls while the rest of the area has very little rainfall and contributes very little towards the runoff in the region. So, it's kind of like you have your house is on fire, but you have a garden hose that you're spraying on it. It helps a little bit, but it doesn't fix the whole problem.
We're exploring how recent changes to the Mississippi River are affecting Wisconsin and beyond with Dennis Totte, director director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. We invite you to the conversation by calling us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the mighty Mississippi? And when we continue, we'll take a look at what can be done to mitigate the drought that we're seeing today. What can we do when we're in these climate changes? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're focusing in on the Mississippi River this morning with our guest, Dennis Toddy, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. And we invite your questions about the river's low water levels at 1-800-642-1234 and the ripple effects we can see throughout our backyard. You can also email us ideas at WPR.org. And Dennis, last month, mayors and towns along the Mississippi asked for more federal help as low water levels on the river continued. What can be done to prevent these water levels from reaching this low, if anything?
You know, it's an interesting thing you talk about of, you know, how do we deal with this? You look at the whole Mississippi River system, and then we include, you know, ones that flow into it. And, you know, the Mississippi River and the Ohio River, the main tributary for both, have dams on them. But those dams are not for holding back major amounts of water to be released whenever you want to mitigate dry conditions. Basically, they are there to maintain a river level that is supportive of navigation. Now, there are a couple tributaries. The Tennessee River does have some dams on it, and when conditions reached a critical point, they were able to release some water from the Tennessee River system to be able to you know, get I think they got back about a foot of water in the Mississippi. The Mississippi River, or the Missouri River system, which drains from the Northern Plains, the upper Rockies to the Northern Plains, also has some dams along it. But they are, you know, by directive, managed completely separately for their own purposes. So they can hold some water back and release some water, but that's only for Missouri River systems. And if you look at the larger aspect, there's not a whole lot they can fix on the Mississippi because of the amount of water that comes from the Missouri. So you are asking a great question that I'm not sure we have an answer for. We know that that droughts do happen on the Mississippi River, and we can kind of work around them when they do. Fortunately, they're not that frequent. But, drought is one of the things that we are concerned about looking ahead, that is a concern for us, that more frequent droughts could be a problem. In addition to, you know, more bigger rainfall events, like you mentioned earlier, there's also an issue that, that we could have bigger floods, and then, bigger dryness along with that. And that's a real problem if you're looking on the shipping aspect. You know, we can move some of those products via rail or other methods, but it's more effective, and we've built our system around transporting on the Mississippi River more frequently, expecting that it's always going to be there and available to us.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Dina joins us near Keeler. Dina, you're on the air with Dennis Toddy from the USDA Midwest Climate Hub.
Hi, Dennis. Thank you for letting me join you. I didn't listen to the rest of the program, just caught a tiny bit of it as I was driving, so I stopped. I'm a marathon canoe racer. I basically live on the edge of the Mississippi River and spend anywhere between 10 to 30 hours a week paddling on the river and its tributaries. What I've observed, and I have a question about, is anybody looking or studying how changes in, for example, agricultural tiling and urban runoff is affecting the actual river level, i.e., we're running water off so quickly into the river systems, it doesn't have time to filter down and travel through the underground aquifer-type systems and springs into the river. And I've certainly noticed very low water levels. For example, the Viking ship, that's a new ship, had trouble getting up and down the river this summer. And there are places that we normally paddle in the backwaters that we couldn't even paddle in because they completely dried up this summer. So that's my question.
Thank you so much, Dina. I appreciate you being our eyes along the Mississippi for us this morning. Dennis, agriculture tiling, the urban runoff, and as you mentioned, the tourism and the that importance in the Mississippi.
Yeah, she hit all the points. I think she was listening earlier. You know, what happens in the way of tiling is an additional complexity to this whole situation. You know, the addition of more tiling, and what we're talking about here is adding, adding pipes essentially to agricultural fields, are a result of what we've seen overall, which is increasing rainfall or more water on the soil. And that is a method of trying to move that water more quickly off the soil and make it more available for agricultural production. There is an advantage to this when you are excessively wet. Say if we had, we had very wet conditions right now and trying to get water off the soils to be able to get it dry sooner, it actually provides some benefit to reduce flooding because, if you're wet in the fall, you move some of that water during a lower flow time in the fall, there's less water that has to be moved in the spring. So it actually is a benefit that way. Can it add to the drought conditions? It can by moving more of that water away. But the situation we're seeing right now is so widespread and some of the deficits are so large that the tiling is not a major aspect to this at this point. We just have had so much, had so much dryness. Wisconsin has been somewhat lucky in that it hasn't been as bad in some of the areas. Not too far away, the Twin Cities area has been kind of a ground zero this year with some of the severity of it. So, but yeah, that people are doing work on that, trying to study that. And there's also discussions about how tiling can be used in conjunction with, things like, can we hold some of that water somewhere and reintroduce it when you have dry conditions later in the year? So there is work being done on that.
Dennis Toddy, our guest, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. And Dina, thank you so much for the call. One of the ramifications here I hadn't thought of until I saw you quoted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Dennis, is the how dry conditions could lead to waterline breaks and pipes breaking in northern states like Wisconsin. Explain that.
Okay, what you have happening is, part of dryness is that you have very dry soils. Crops and other plants that grow have removed a lot of water from the soil as they've grown through the year. More has evaporated, so you have very dry soils. As we get cold in the wintertime, particularly if you get lots of cold early and before you have snow cover, that freezes the soil, and it can freeze the soil very deep. Because dry soils will allow, because water has a high heat content, it's harder to warm up, it's harder to cool down, but we have very dry soils that frost depth can go very deep into the soil. And what that leads to is we can have waterline breaks. So I would expect to see more waterline breaks around the upper Midwest this year. These are water main kinds of things, or potentially frozen water lines overall. If you have a water line that's not buried deep enough, or in some cases, even if it's buried deep enough, the frost depths may be bad enough that this can be a problem. We had a problem with this back in 2014, where we had a similar situation, dry soils going into the fall, got very cold in the winter, and we need to have sustained, pretty persistent cold. Moderate cold is not too big an issue, but that's something people should keep an eye on and watch throughout the year, because I think this we may see more of this than we're hoping for.
Is there a bigger picture story here? I've seen about the Colorado River. I've seen stories about the Rhine in Europe. Is there a concern about our freshwater streams globally, nationally, beyond the Mississippi?
Well, certainly there is. Trying to connect the Colorado and the Mississippi, that's one of the ideas that is tossed out fairly regularly for the desert Southwest as well. We'll just figure out a way to get water from the Mississippi over there. Well, okay, when the Mississippi is low, that can be a problem also. But that's, there are a number of issues with what we call cross basin transport, transporting water from the Mississippi basin to the Colorado basin. This is also an issue in the way of climate changes, in the way of, more pervasive droughts, and situations where we have lack of precipitation like we've seen, in addition to higher what we call evapotranspiration, where you have a lack of rainfall, but then warmer temperatures leads to more water withdrawn and used from the soil, and that combination leads to worsening of the dry conditions. So this is something we are concerned about as potentially seeing more frequently in larger areas, and especially some of these areas. Yeah, you're right about Europe. You know, typically rivers that we expect to see water in on a regular basis, this could be happening more frequently. So it is a concern and something we need to take seriously.
Hey, Dennis, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Happy to do it.
Dennis Toddy is director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. Coming up next, we have Your Wisconsin Life after the news, and then WPR's Danielle Kading joins us to bring us the very latest in what's next in Line 5, Enbridge's Line 5 that runs through northern Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it's time once again for Wisconsin Life. Here's Maureen McCollum with a story about a legendary Milwaukee musician.
Imagine making it as a musician not only once, but at two distinct moments in your life. That's what happened to jazz saxophonist Frank Morgan of Milwaukee. Author Dean Robbins brings us the story on the musician's rebirth and stardom.
Frank Morgan grew up in Milwaukee, playing jazz guitar at an early age. But in 1940, his father took 7-year-old Frank to see a concert by alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. The experience changed his life. The minute Morgan heard Parker's starkly beautiful sound, he knew that alto sax was his destiny. He and his father went backstage to meet the genius who'd helped create the modern jazz style called bebop. With typical generosity, Parker took an interest in the boy and got him started on a reed instrument. Morgan became his protege, copying the master's jagged melodies and quicksilver rhythms. At 14, Frank was sitting in with top jazz players in Los Angeles. And at 22, when he released his debut album, word spread that Frank Morgan might become the next Charlie Parker. But it didn't happen. In the mid-1950s, Morgan succumbed to drug addiction, just as Parker had. His heroin habit led to a life of crime, and he spent most of the next 30 years behind bars. Instead of becoming a jazz celebrity, he performed for fellow inmates in the San Quentin prison band. Here he is on WHYY's Fresh Air in 1987.
In prison, the instrument was the thing that kept me sane, if you will. And the chance to play it, you know, kept me with hope.
After his release in 1985, Morgan finally recorded a second album, drawing on decades of pent-up emotion. Since prison had isolated him from a generation's worth of musical changes, listeners got the impression that a pure 1950s bebop pioneer had been magically transplanted to the 1980s. Morgan's resurrection fascinated the public, and his friendly smile began beaming out of magazines and TV screens. Audiences were touched by his sublime improvisations. He expressed gratitude for his long-delayed fame and committed himself to earning people's respect.
I really intend to play, and to play my heart out.
That meant staying off drugs, of course, which required extraordinary effort. To avoid temptation, Morgan threw himself into practicing and recording. He also moved back to Milwaukee in 1994 to be with supportive family members. I had a chance to interview Morgan after his return to Wisconsin, a state he dubbed Pretty Hip. He credited Milwaukee with giving him a great start in music, and the city's schools with providing an excellent education. And he was overwhelmed by the warm welcome he received from local jazz fans. I was one of those fans. I saw Morgan play a spectacular concert in Madison and continued to follow his career until he died from cancer in 2007 at age 73. His final years are one of the greatest second acts in jazz history, and his recordings endure as a testament to redemption and rebirth. Here he is on NPR's Piano Jazz.
Well, it's great to be alive, you know. Every day is beautiful.
In our interview, Morgan explained his musical strategy of channeling everything he felt through his horn. His goal, he said, was to make a direct connection between his heart and a listener's heart. I'd say, mission accomplished.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on saxophonist Frank Morgan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And perhaps by now you've heard about Line 5, this pipeline carrying up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids per day across 645 miles from Superior through northern Wisconsin and Michigan and on to Ontario. Line 5's almost 70 years old now, and last week a federal judge said there's a real risk of significant rupture, and if that happens, it would be catastrophic to Lake Superior and the Bad River watershed. So what's your take on the future of Line 5 in Wisconsin? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email available, ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading's a reporter in Wisconsin's Public Radio Superior Bureau. And Danny, welcome back to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me on, Lee.
So your story from last week, U.S. District Judge William Connolly's ordering Enbridge and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa to agree on measures to avoid spills. What could those measures include?
So basically, the judge is asking that Enbridge and Bad River get together and discuss emergency measures to avoid a catastrophic spill sometime in the near future. And so the things that he's asked them to do is to meet and discuss installation of emergency shutoff valves, a protocol for shutting down and purging the line should erosion threaten to expose it, and projects that could slow erosion near the banks of the pipeline on the Bad River.
So when the judge the judge's order followed him, tell me why he thinks this would be catastrophic for the Bad River watershed as well as Lake Superior.
Yeah, well, one of the things that he noted in his order is that the nearest shutoff valves for Line 5 are about 14 miles apart on either side of this area of the river that is referred to as the meander. And that's where erosion is encroaching on the pipeline, and they're seeing some scouring of the river bottom. And he said that that makes it unlikely, because it's so far apart, that they could activate those shutoff valves in time to prevent around 20,000 gallons of crude oil and natural gas liquids that are in that segment of pipe from spilling into the Bad River.
Are there reasons that Judge Connolly cited leads him to believe that there could be a failure of Line 5?
Well, I mean, this is something that's been debated by Enbridge and Bad River for years now. I mean, and if you just kind of take a look at the context of the last decade, we have seen some significant flooding events here in northern Wisconsin in 2012, 2016, and 2018. And these events were things that were only supposed to happen once every 500 years or once every 1,000 years. And in 2016, you know, we saw the Bad River spill over its banks and it flooded a major east-west highway. And there's concern that erosion from these events or debris that might be washed down river could, you know, cause some sort of rupture on the pipeline and threaten the tribe's water resources and Lake Superior.
So, as you reported last week, in August, the DNR investigated a possible spill near the Bad River Reservation after an Enbridge contractor reported contaminated soil. What was found there, if anything?
Oh, that was Enbridge reported a trace of oil, like a tablespoon of product, in an area just south of Ashland. There was no smell of oil or odor detected at the site. They believe it's historical contamination.
Okay.
But they addressed that with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I, as far as I know, I think that investigation is ongoing.
Are there other parties concerned here? What does Michigan say about this? What is our, has our DNR weighed in? What are some, are there other concerned parties that would get involved in what the future of Line 5 could be?
Well, I mean, it depends on where you're at related to this, because I think there's a lot of people concerned about the future of Line 5. You have people on the side of labor and business and just wanting to see this pipeline continue to operate because it's a major source of energy for northern Michigan and the upper Midwest. It, you know, it supplies a lot of the oil that's used in refineries. And there's concern that if this pipeline were shut down, that would have detrimental effects to regional economies. And there's concerns that it would harm our trade relationship with Canada because Canada has invoked this little known treaty that governs cross-border transportation of oil between the U.S. and Canada. And then on the other side, you've got environmental groups and citizens and the tribe who are very concerned about the potential for a spill, considering that the pipeline, as you said, is almost 70 years old. And we've seen incidents in Michigan where there have been anchor strikes to the pipeline underneath the Straits of Mackinac. You know, it's just there are threats to Line 5 that people have become more and more concerned about as time goes on. And they want to see those risks mitigated so that we don't see oil spilling into the Bad River or Lake Superior.
And the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Danny, they sued the Canadian energy firm Enbridge back in 2019 to try to shut down or remove Line 5. It's been almost a decade now since the easements for that pipeline to run through the tribal lands were not renewed. What are some of the options on the table for the relationship between Line 5 and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa?
Well, I'd say that the relationship between Enbridge and Bad River right now is pretty contentious. I mean, they're in a legal dispute over the future of the pipeline, and they have totally different worldviews about how they think this situation should be dealt with. And it should be noted that the judge said that Enbridge illegally trespassed on Bad River lands after the tribe decided not to renew those easements on 12 parcels of land on their reservation. You know, Enbridge is saying that they maintain easements for the majority of the pipeline, but the judge has said that they're entitled to compensation for illegally trespassing there. And, you know, he wouldn't go so far, though, as to shut down this pipeline as the tribe has asked because of those concerns about the effect on the regional economies and our trade relationship with Canada.
So we will ask what happens if Enbridge and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are unable to reach an agreement as so ordered by U.S. District Judge William Conley of our guest, Danny Kading, when we continue. She is a reporter at the Wisconsin Public Radio Superior Bureau. And if you have questions about the future of Line 5 through northern Wisconsin, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Danny also has an update this morning on our chronic wasting disease numbers and a deer hunt update. So we'll get to that when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, back in a minute with Danny Kading on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're discussing the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline in northern Wisconsin, carrying millions of gallons of oil and natural gas each day. We're inviting you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest, WPR reporter and Superior Daniel Kadings, with us for 10 more minutes. And Danielle, U.S. District Judge William Connolly is ordering Enbridge and the Bad River Band to Lake Superior Chippewa to agree on measures to avoid what could be potentially catastrophic spills to the watershed. But what happens, as you mentioned, the relationship's been contentious. This is all a result of a lawsuit. That's why they're in the courts. So what would happen if Enbridge and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are unable to reach an agreement on measures to prevent these spills?
Well, it appears that if they are unable to reach an agreement, that the courts will decide how best to address this issue. And if that happens, I don't think that either side is going to be happy. And really, I don't think that either side is going to be happy anyway, because they haven't come to an agreement up until this point. Like I said, they just have totally different worldviews about what they think should be done with this pipeline. Bad River wants to see it shut down completely. No ifs, ands, or buts. They think it can be done within 18 months and that they can resort to other measures to get that oil to market. Enbridge says that this would just be a terrible thing for the regional economy, and they wouldn't be able to get the product to refiners, and that would have a trickle-down effect and potentially lose thousands of jobs. So I just don't see a way that the tribe and Enbridge right now are going to come to an agreement, because they both are very dug in on their sides. And so they're going to come up with their own proposal, or if they can come to an agreement, a joint proposal to the judge by December 17th. And then a week later, they have to come in with something final by Christmas Eve. So we'll see what happens and if they can come to some sort of compromise. Otherwise, I think it would be up for the court to decide.
Yeah, that's just 10 days away. Is there any indication that either side has met yet?
You know, I can't speak to that. But, you know, I'll definitely keep you posted with any updates on the matter.
So the judge's new ruling does allow the pipeline to continue operating. But what is the status of the new pipeline that Enbridge wants to build that would run around the easement of the Bad River Reservation? And would that mitigate the concerns over potential catastrophic leaks?
Well, I mean, that's certainly what Enbridge is advocating for. You know, they're proposing this $450 million pipeline that would run south of the reservation. It would run around 41 miles around the tribal lands there. But that's not something that the tribe is welcoming either. You know, Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. has said that they want Enbridge out of the watershed completely. And, you know, if they're crossing water resources upstream, that's still going to flow downstream through their reservation. So they don't see that as a workable solution from the tribe's perspective. Enbridge thinks that it can be done, but, you know, we've previously reported that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found that the state hasn't yet fully analyzed the impacts of this reroute that the company is proposing, that they had nearly 200 recommendations of things that they should examine related to water resources, climate change, and treaty rights. And so that process is still ongoing.
And has the judge in this legal dispute weighed in on what Enbridge wants to build around the Bad River Reservation?
Well, previously, when the judge ruled that Enbridge had, in fact, trespassed, he had been inclined to tie a solution to constructing that proposed reroute, and he had hoped to see that done within 5 years. But if you look at other projects that Enbridge has built, like the Line 3 replacement, you know, the timeline for that project changed over and over and over again, and that was because of repeated challenges by tribes in Minnesota contesting that project and how it might impact their water resources. And we also saw with that project that, in fact, Enbridge did affect water resources and that there were water quality violations and aquifer breaches during construction. So people do have reason to be concerned given Enbridge's track record. And the Bad River Tribe is hoping to avoid what happened elsewhere on other pipelines that this company owns.
So the timeline going forward is short, and we would expect some updates in the next 10 days or so, I would expect. Right, Danny?
I think that they're going to have to submit their plans by December 17th and come up with their final best offer by Christmas Eve. So there will be something that we'll be able to look at.
Danielle Kading, our guest, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Superior, taking a look at her recent reporting. And let's move on to the gun deer hunting season. Stake figures show hunters killed, around 14% more, 15% more deer this year than last year. What are we looking at behind these numbers? What may have contributed to more deer during the 9-day gun season that ended just last week, Danny?
Well, I think definitely it was the weather.
Oh.
We saw good conditions for hunters out there. There was snow on the ground in the northern part of the state. That helped improve visibility for hunters. So, you know, if they shot a deer, they could see blood in the snow and track them. I think that helped. And then also, you know, there was the corn harvest. The majority of it was finished. And so that improved success for deer hunters, even though, you know, some areas of the state might have seen a spotty harvest. And so I just think it was better weather for hunters. You know, there was some wind, it looked like, opening weekend, and that could have affected things. But overall, we saw more than 203,000 deer harvested during the 9-day season. And I believe the buck harvest was up 15% and the antlerless deer kill was up nearly 14%. So it was definitely a better season than last year.
So now in your reporting, the DNR said last week it's going to take anywhere from 9 to 14 days to get our CWD numbers processed. But do we have any updates on the wild deer that have tested positive for chronic wasting disease this morning?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the DNR said as part of their wrap up to the season that there was a facility in Lincoln County that tested positive for chronic wasting disease right before opening weekend. And there was also a wild deer that tested positive in Kenosha County. And that was the county's first positive detection in the wild deer herd since 2003. Mm. And, you know, as you know, this was first detected 20 years ago. And since then, this disease has spread to affect at least 60 counties across the state. So it's not something that's gone away. It's continued to spread statewide. And hunters were encouraged to get their deer tested so that they know whether or not the venison that they're going to eat this winter is safe.
Danielle Kading, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Lee.
Danielle Kading is the Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Superior. We take a look this morning at the latest in Line 5 with updates in the days to come to be expected, as well as the latest in our deer hunting numbers, gun deer hunting numbers this season, and an update from the DNR and the chronic wasting disease statistics. Coming up after the news, we're going to be taking a look at your social media, how you use it, and how it, you could say, may be using you. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.